Hi, happy Friday. Welcome to the Friday News Feedback. I am James Williams.
And I am Jorge Ribas.
And today we are going to do something a little differently. If you've been following us in the past couple months, usually Will is the moderator, Will Johnson, and we have a guest judge in. But today, Will is actually out on vacation, so it's just Jorge and I.
Will's sitting on a beach somewhere, just enjoying a Mai Tai.
So Jorge and I are going to read our stories to you, and then we are going to ask you to be the guest judge for this week. So we'll ask you to email whichever story you think is the best one and should win this week into us. And that email address is pod_cast@discovery.com.
That's pod_cast@discovery.com.
Cast.
Did I say cast?
Yeah, you say it's cast.
What's a podcast?
I don't know. Okay, so let's get started. Jorge, okay. You want to go first?
I will. So researchers from Purdue University and work funded by Intel have demonstrated a new technology using tiny ionic wind engines that would improve cooling our computer chips. So right now, you got your laptop sitting on your lap, and pretty soon all the hairs on your leg are singed off. It's going to just get worse because as these computer chips get faster and more powerful, right now they're like at 2 gigahertz or whatever. As they get more powerful, they're going to get hotter. It's called the heat transfer coefficient. And what they found is using these ionic wind engines in combination with a conventional fan really decreased the amount of heat that was coming out of these computer chips.
So that's, first of all, that is a great name for a fan.
Ionic wind engine?
Yeah.
Right.
That's pretty cool. So they're just gonna make our computers cooler.
Cooler.
How much cooler?
Well, what they found is that up to 60 degrees Celsius or 140 degrees Fahrenheit cooler. So basically if your laptop is operating at, 200 degrees Fahrenheit, which would be scorching, it would be down to, 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
So do our laptops get 200 degrees? That's
right. Well, I know that when I've measured the heat of mine, it actually does get up to about 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
You measure how
well.
High.
I have a little. I don't like stick a thermometer in the CD drive, but I like, they have a little chart that you can keep a track of how hot your laptop gets, and mine gets pretty hot.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
so
crazy.
And the ionic wind is basically what it is just ions or electrically charged atoms spinning around, and if you have a device that contained a positively charged wire or an anode and negatively charged electrodes called cathodes. And along the way, the electrons collide with air molecules producing positively charged ions. And basically what it's doing is just creating like a big wind, an ionic wind that is like a breeze that cools the computer chip.
Huh. So they're basically like little nano fans.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is.
All right, cool. All right, well, my first story is being published in the August issue of Psychological Science, and it looks at why it is that some people are unable to distinguish faces from other races. And what they found is it doesn't have as much to do with race or nationality or anything like that. It has more to do with the fact that humans generally tend to categorize our social groups as in groups or out groups. So you could have like a mixed race group of friends, and if you view them all as part of your in group, then you would be able to distinguish their features. Whereas if there was another group, like say it's like the Jets and the Sharks, like if you're with the Jets, like according to this study, then you would totally understand or recognize all the facial features of the other Jets, right? But then the Sharks come bumping around the corner, and you might not be able to distinguish their faces as from each other as much because they're with the Sharks.
Are you referencing the Outsiders?
No, West Side Story.
You mean like I was thinking more of like, what was the groups in the Outsiders?
I don't remember.
The Socs?
No, that's, that is I was thinking of the Warriors. The guys with the overalls.
So
and the
many
rollers.
Movies about gangs.
I know.
So basically what they're saying is that it's less to do with, I don't know, that can be construed when someone says, I don't want to, make anyone mad, but if someone says, someone from one race or another says to about another race, they all look the same to me.
Yep.
It's less to do with, that person being racist than it is with that person's brain just not working the way.
Well, it has to do with like that. When you look at another race, and they all look the same to you, it has more to do with the fact that you don't view the whoever it is from that race as part of your in group.
Okay, but then that just sounds to me just like I don't recognize that person because I don't know that person, right?
Well, that's kind of what they're getting at here. So it doesn't have as much to do with race as it does just social groups. So that can include race, it can include nationality, occupation, that sort of thing. The way they actually did this study is they got people from Miami University students and had them look at faces that they said were fellow Miami students. Then they had them look at faces from a different university, Marshall, and I guess their big rivals, and they were all white people, and they could pick out the facial features of the people who they thought were from Miami University and not as much from the Marshall University, even though in actuality none of the people none of the faces went to either university.
This study sounds like it happened on Facebook.com.
Maybe it did. No, I don't think it did. But anyway, so there you have it.
Cool. Well, continuing the hot-button racial topics, a new study on Latino immigrants finds that, in contrast to past generations of European immigrants, a significant portion of second- and third-generation Latino Americans identify with a Latino racial category rather than white, I guess, the white category, the Caucasian. And basically what the paper found was that using 1990 and 2000 U.S. Census reports, over 40% of Latinos selected other when they were asked to check a race category. So the race categories were white, African-American, Asian, Native American, or other. There's no Latino race category because Latino is more of an ethnicity than an actual race. But the Latinos, 40% of these Latinos who were asked to check a category checked other.
So like they thought those 40% felt that they were a different race?
A different race, not Caucasian, not white. But that doesn't even really figure into every, like, a broad umbrella Latino, because what they found is that Cubans, at a rate of about 90%, overwhelmingly self-identified themselves as white, while Puerto Ricans and Mexicans at around 50% were much less likely to select that white category. But still, one-third of dark-skinned Latino respondents called themselves white. And what this suggested to the researchers was that there's a great deal of ambiguity about the meaning of white for Latinos. So, you know, the word white, I guess, is just becoming sort of vague and broad at the same time. So,
like some sort of like a catch-all.
Yeah, right.
Race or whatever.
Yeah, I guess. And they also found that the increasing exposure to American culture, which would, you know, second and third generation Latino Americans would be, you know, basically American at that point, led to a Spanish racial self-identification over white. So it was almost kind of like a holding on to their Spanish or Latino roots.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a contrast to immigrants that came from Italy and Ireland and European Jews who actually had, like, outright campaigned against being labeled other and wanted to be incorporated in the white category. But these groups are actually saying, no, you know what, like, keep the other in there. We'll check other. And this might lead to, you know, creating new, you know, I guess, racial categories like Spanish Caribbean or Latin American or something like that.
Huh. Now, let me ask you, are you a second generation?
I'm a second generation Cuban, and I guess, but I mean, I look like an Irishman. So I'll just put white. Or, you know, maybe I'll just check every box just to confuse everybody.
Okay, so cool. My second story has to do with batteries. Researchers at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and if I butchered that name, I'm sorry, they're in Troy, New York. And what they did is figure out how to make a battery on simple black paper. And they have pictures of it. And this stuff, it looks like a little square of construction paper that's flexible. It's lightweight, it's ultra thin, and they're gearing, you know, they're saying like this is kind of the battery that's going to bring us into the next age of gadgets for tomorrow, and it also could help with like transportation, with like cars and also medical equipment. It can function at temperatures up to 300 degrees Fahrenheit down to 100 below zero. The study was published in the August 13th Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. But what's cool about it is that it's literally like made on paper. It's got these carbon nanotubes that are embedded into the paper, and then the electrolytes that I guess you know that are the necessary component to get the batteries to give off the charge is soaked into the paper. It's made with the same cellulose that's made up of like newspapers and lunch bags and that sort of thing.
So that sounds like the battery is almost biodegradable, much more so than batteries we have today that just sit in landfills and, you know, take up space.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And one of the really interesting things I thought is that the electrolytes that it runs on are also found in, like, human blood and sweat and tears. And so they're saying that, and it is, it's like natural. So it can help, it could actually help like pacemakers and that sort of thing without putting a toxic chemical into the body. So yeah, it's kind of like a green battery source too, I guess, in that sense. So
very cool. All right, science. So my third and final story out of the University of North Carolina finds that those painful emotional memories that you would really like to forget are actually the ones that are toughest to leave behind, especially when the memories are created through visual cues. And what they found is that even mild emotional events like getting a bad grade on a test when you were in school or, you know, having someone say something negative about you sticks with you for a much longer time than you would like and, you know, can't be forgotten as easily as something that, you know, like that doesn't really mean anything. And that kind of makes sense, you know, like things that kind of emotionally affect you would stick with you. But we intentionally forget things. There's things like, you know, outdated phone numbers and
certain chores,
people's birthdays.
Yeah.
And we forget this stuff. Basically, what it does is help update our memory and our brain with new information, you know. And then I would also assume that, you know, so your brain isn't filled with a bunch of useless junk and gets kind of like full like a hard drive on a computer, that some of this stuff just kind of goes, clicks down to the trash bin and goes away forever. But things that, you know, we are, you know, are kind of unpleasant or that we, you know, that kind of just stay with us forever, really, that we can't intentionally forget these emotional events as easily as we might some of these more mundane things. But
it's so cruel that like the harder you try and forget something, the more you can't.
Yeah. I mean, I still remember, you know, getting, you know, rejected by some girl in seventh grade. Right. Why?
What was her name?
Eileen.
Nice.
Do you want me to get a last name too? She might be listening.
I don't know. Maybe better not.
And then they were, you know, saying that a different study would be needed to examine, like, what treatment and coping strategies might help, you know, people who, you know, voluntarily forget an unwanted memory. So they're still studying, you know, how to forget some of this stuff. And the study was published in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology. So if you want to read it for yourself.
Right on. And if they forgot already, what is it? Never mind. That's a bad joke. My last story comes from the University of Michigan. It has to do with soaps. The University of Michigan researchers looked at the difference between antibacterial soaps and regular soaps. And you know, antibacterial soaps, I feel like really hit the scene a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And like everything suddenly was antibacterial. Like we started waging massive war against
bacteria.
Yeah.
It was like the war against bacteria.
Yeah. So, well, it turns out that soap is no more, antibacterial soap is no more effective in killing germs than regular soap. Not only that, but the antibacterial soap might actually make some bacteria resistant to common drugs like amoxicillin. It actually could build a resistance up to some of the other ways that we try to kill bacteria.
That is not good. Yeah, I mean, when we were growing up, it was just soap. Like,
right.
There was another,
yeah.
Like, you know, newfangled.
There was no fancy soap.
Yeah, we didn't have no fancy soap in our day. But, yeah, I've been reading a little bit and hearing about this that people are, some theories that of why, you know, maybe kids are more allergic to things these days or there's an increase in asthma has to do with the overuse of these antibacterial soaps. Mm-hmm. Like, that our human bodies are just, we're supposed to have some level of bacteria and killing all of them. Actually, like you said in the study, makes us resistant to or makes bacteria resistant to some of these really widely used drugs.
Right. The study this just focuses on the actual drug resistance part of that, but yeah, it's and they haven't found it. Like, they're not saying that this is definitely the case. They haven't detected it at the population level, but in the lab they were able to show that like E. coli bacteria actually adapted to this, to these antibacterial soaps in the lab and made them resistant. One of the problems might be that there's not as much of that active ingredient in the consumer soap as there is at like hospitals and that sort of thing. And it doesn't say that why they don't just raise it to raise the levels in regular soap.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to get serious about winning the war on bacteria, we got to raise those levels.
Yeah, but yeah, I think that we have to be careful because there's like lots of good bacteria too.
There is good bacteria.
You have to be selective in which bacteria.
I'm not really sure what bacteria is good bacteria, but there's probably some. I mean, like, you know, just like anything, there's good bacteria and bad bacteria.
Yeah. It's not. Yeah, the world. It's a gray world, isn't it? Even in the world of bacteria. It's a complex.
What did the bacteria ever do to us? Yeah, actually, it's done a lot. Yeah, I guess they've done a lot.
All right. Well, that's our feedback for today. Those are our stories, and let's just review what they are so that people can refresh their memories.
Okay. My first story was new technology that has dramatic chip cooling potential for any of our future computers. My second story was asking the question whether Latinos identify with white or whether they're identifying with a whole different new ethnicity. And my last story was about the memories that you want to forget are often the hardest ones to lose.
Okay, so my three stories were why you are sometimes unable to distinguish faces of other races or, in actuality, other social groups, in-groups and out-groups. My second story was about this cool new battery that is made of paper and could actually be printed out like a newspaper, like on a, they like make like a battery press. And then my last one is about how antibacterial soap is just as effective as regular soap and may actually carry a bit of a risk along with it. So those are our stories.
And I guess, how is it going to work? Are people going to write in their votes and then we're going to tally them and then we're going to decide who the winner was and we'll announce that next week?
Yep.
Oh,
that's what
right.
We'll do. And the email for that again is pod_cast with a T. At discovery.com. Send us an email. Tell us which story you think should win this week. Feel free to throw some comments in there one way or another.
You know, there's a little more drama involved than usual.
Actually, you're right, because next week, if it's 9-7 right now, next week with if I win this week's and next week's, then we're tied.
So for Discovery News, I'm Jorge Rivas.
And I'm James Williams. Have a good week.